Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
We're speaking to you from Hay on Wye, where we've been dodging the cloudbursts at the Hay Literary Festival, a bountiful celebration for book lovers that has seen a star-studded lineup this year, including Margaret Atwood, Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan, Germaine Greer, and many, many more. But often, it's at the smaller events that the best surprises can be found. Sian, what have been your favourites?
Well, you're quite right that the smaller ones are usually the best. I went to a really great one yesterday, which was a talk about plants with Dame Ottoline Lacer, who works at Cambridge University, just about the inner life of plants and all the weird little things about how they communicate and basically how they function, because they do make decisions, but they don't have feelings and they don't have brains. So it's quite a weird sort of set of contradictory facts, but she explained it really, really well, and that was really enjoyable. Also, Judith Kerr was absolutely fantastic. I saw her a few days ago, and she was just talking about her whole career, but she's about, I think she's like 70 95. Years. Yeah, she's turning 95 in 2 weeks, and she's about 70 years older than me, and her memory was just incredible. It's better than mine.
It's all that training at festivals over the years. I've always loved the Cambridge University sessions, which I think is what your plant lecture was, wasn't
it? Yeah.
Well, basically all the lectures I should have gone to as a student, but I didn't because I was too well adolescent. The white and the grey matter in my brain was still sorting themselves out. I always knew there had to be a good reason, but it was confirmed by the cognitive neuroscientist Sarah Jane Blakemore. She's actually not at Cambridge, but at University College London, and we'll be hearing from her later. But I also sneaked into a lecture by sociologist Terry Apter about praise and blame. It apparently takes 5 pieces of praise to undo the damage of 1 bit of blame. And it also turns out that the difference between a divorced couple and the one that stays together has less to do with sex, or how much they row, or even how many interests they have in common, as on how much they praise or blame each other. Anyway, what sets journalists apart from most festival goers is that we hacks try to go to different things, to cast our net as widely as possible, while punters, as we call them, tend to go to the same things as their friends so they can discuss them afterwards, hence the buzz. What do you think the buzz has been at this year's festival, Sian? I.e., what is it that people are really talking about?
Well, it's quite funny because being here last year, I happened to overhear a lot of people coming out of events complaining about how political a lot of the events were last year. And there were quite a lot of politicians that were here. There was Bernie Sanders and one of the Miliband brothers and all sorts. And this year, the presence of politicians is noticeably less, but politics has really been hanging over everything. And I think this year people are actually looking for a bit of reassurance. They're quite happy to talk about politics. We were talking to one of the journalists that was here with us in the press, and he was saying he thinks that the words fear and the words empathy have been used in every single event that he's been to this year, which is kind of a remarkable observation. And I think it's probably true. But there's been a lot of talk about the effect of technology on democracy, a lot of talk about what the Brexit negotiations are going to look like, because of course next year's Hay Festival will fall after Britain leaves the EU next year. So it sort of felt like a lot of the programming this year has sort of oriented towards discussions that people have started wanting to have, which they certainly didn't want to have last year. And also this year it's Golden Man Booker, because this year's it's the 50th year of the Man Booker Prize, and there have been events this year for the Golden Booker, which is a sort of best of the winners of the last 50 years. And so the shortlist was announced at the Hay Festival this year. They had 5 judges, which were Robert McCrum, Lem Sisse, Simon Mayo, Camilla Shamsie and Holly McNish, and they were assigned a decade each. A decade of reading, which sounds quite tempting, really. And I'm a bit jealous of Lem Sisse because he got to do the 1980s, which is kind of the decade you really, really want to read. But the Golden Man Booker shortlist was announced this year at the Hay Festival, and the shortlist is In a Free State by V.S. Naipaul, representing the 1970s, Moon Tiger by Penelope Lively, representing the 1980s, The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, which is representing the 1990s, Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, representing the 2000s, and the 20-teens, as I call it, are being represented by Lincoln in the Bardo, last year's Man Booker winner, by George Saunders. What did you think of it, Claire? What did you think of that shortlist? Because there were a couple of surprises on there, weren't there?
Well, yeah, 1980s is my decade, so I was really delighted to see it coming through. And in a way, the news story of this is that Penelope Lively's Moon Tiger, a book that got pretty dismissed at the time of publication, a sort of very middle brow, has actually finally knocked Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children off the top spot, as anybody who's watched the Booker over many years will know. For both the 25th and the 40th anniversaries, Midnight's Children came through as the best ever Booker book. And so I think it was about time it was knocked off. What about you?
Well, I mean, I'm a very big George Saunders fan, and I know that it's been a very divisive book. A lot of people have felt that it wasn't necessarily a book that they wanted to finish. I think we had George Saunders on the podcast just before he won the Booker last year, and he was saying he'd got a lot of feedback from fans that a lot of them conked out around page 30. And it's very interesting being at the Hay Festival this year, because there was an event chaired by Gabby Wood and attended by the authors Philippe Sands, Elif Shafak and Juan Gabriel Vasquez discussing the shortlist. And Philippe Sands was very down on Lincoln in the Bardo. And I felt like shouting from the audience that he has to try again. He didn't finish it. He needs to try again. And he conked out around page 30, which is exactly what George said would happen. And he seemed to think that the challenging nature of the form, because it basically looks like a screenplay on the page, was somehow elitist. And I really don't think it is an elitist book. And I really would love for him to try it again and see if he can find something to love in there. Anyway, here is a bit from that event, the Golden Man Booker event at Hay, which was recorded the day after the shortlist was officially announced. And you'll hear the authors Philippe Sands, Elif Shafak and Juan Gabriel Vasquez discussing the books with Gabby Wood.
I had read four of these books earlier. I hadn't read Naipaul. And maybe I had my own, barriers too. So that was a new discovery for me, this book in particular by Naipaul. But as you said, I think rereading, the act of rereading, because I have changed, times have changed. What I observed in all five of them was perhaps in so many ways, they're so relevant today, they're so timeless today. And maybe this question, when so much madness is happening in the world, when so much insanity is taking place, either due to the times we're living in or because of the geography we happen to be in, what can the individual do? Can, you know, can our personalities make a difference? I think that question is very much alive in all five books. And of course, memory, how we connect to a place, to the past, how much of it we remember, even when we suppress, how it comes back. And subjectivity, we were talking about this earlier, how the voice, the narrative voice changes, especially in Penelope Lively's book with the Moon Tiger. I think it's amazing. It's such a precious gem, those shifts back and forth. So it was really, I really enjoyed the journey. What intimidated me, perhaps, was to have to compare them, because so they're so different. And I didn't exactly think they belong in 1970s, 1980s. I think that's a bit dangerous, because in so many ways I see lots of things that are timeless in each novel. So I don't want to see them exactly as the product of a decade, as the product of a time. But to compare them, you know, that's going to be a bit difficult, because they're so different, each and every one of them.
Well, the fact that they're a product of their time, I mean, that's a fact, right? That's just a fact of their publication, but the fact that they exist beyond their time is also... So when they're written and when they're read, are almost sort of slippery time frames, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I think it would be a very interesting exercise to do, to try to imagine The English Patient being published in 1970. Mm. Why not?
Yeah.
Or George Saunders in 1980.
Well, or Naipaul now, or, you know.
Or Penelope Lively's book Moon Tiger the day before yesterday.
Yeah.
It's such a pertinent book. I think one of the great discoveries that I made was Moon Tiger. Moon Tiger is an absolutely fabulous book that I didn't know anything about.
Yeah.
It's not that I had heard it existed. I follow English language literature very closely. I knew three of these books. I had read them. I had reread many times two of them.
Which ones?
In a Free State, which was very important for me at a certain moment in my early years as a writer, trying to explore different ways to write about countries such as these. But I had never heard the title Moon Tiger spoken by anyone. And it is now part of my dream team of 20th century novels. It's such an astonishing book. I think the big thing about these books is that they all, the thing they have in common is this very contemporary, this is why they speak to us in such a strong way, very contemporary way of thinking about one of the great, one of the big questions in our current lives. Who has the right to tell our story? How do we deal with the past in words? Who are we willing to allow the all-important right to suggest a version of our past? All these books are trying to do just that. They're trying to deal with the past in words, and they reflect, some of them explicitly, like Moon Tiger, on the way we build a narrative of our past. And these are very, very important issues right now, where the narrative reconstruction of the past is becoming an issue of contention, an international conflict, and all these victories of falsified narratives that led, for instance, to the victory of Donald Trump, that led, for instance, to the defeat of the Colombian peace agreements a couple of years ago. They all have to do with this thing. How do we build a narrative about our past? And all these books are trying to do just that.
Before the panelists gave their verdicts, they asked the audience who they would choose and were faced with what looked to be a tie break.
I'm not quite sure. It's between Penelope Lively and Michael Ondaatje. So let's do that again. Ondaatje and Lively. Oh. I think it's more for Lively. Is it?
It's neck and neck.
Is it neck and neck?
Close,
yeah, so close.
Yeah.
It's so very close.
Okay, right. Now I'm going to let you... Here's a drum roll. What are you saying?
But do we pick two, right?
No, pick one. I'm just saying if you suddenly have a terrible...
Because these were my two, you know?
Don't beat each other up.
Lively and Ondaatje, the two. Those were my two.
Okay, why don't you say two?
No. Weirdly, it's much... it's easier for me to pick just one.
Okay, good.
Which one?
Because and that will be just because of the sense of mending an injustice I have committed as a reader.
Oh, the Moon Tiger.
Yeah.
Okay, too deep.
I would be Ondaatje and Lively, actually. Yeah, but if I had to choose one, it would be Ondaatje. I would pick Ondaatje.
But okay. If Gabriel is saying
no pressure right now.
but if so this
yeah,
is,
everything.
So you have got the same two as you two.
Yeah.
And Penelope Lively is sort of winning if you feel very strongly about that and you two wouldn't mind.
Well, if I had to choose one, if I'm doing what Juan Gabriel's doing, I would choose Ondaatje. Because the thing about Ondaatje that is, if I was stuck with a single book, I could reread Ondaatje, I think, and over an extended period of time, get more and different things out of it on repeated rereadings. And I suspect that may not happen in the same way with Lively. But
yeah.
I'm
choosing Lively because of the sense of discovery, yeah. Because I didn't know
that. Guilt-ridden.
I've read The English Patient three times, probably. So I've done what you're saying,
yeah.
and it's an amazing experience.
Okay.
I just feel bad about In a Free State, which is such a wonderful novel and formally.
He's bringing it back in. It's coming up from behind.
But how subjective it is, right? Yeah. If you had a different, you know, five judges, it would be completely different books.
But as we've already suggested, fiction is only one part of what goes on at a festival. I chaired a session with the rapper turned public intellectual Akala about his book, Natives, Race and Class in the Ruins of Empire, which attracted a sellout audience. Here's what happened when I asked him to rap a chapter entitled Interlude, A Guide to Denial.
You have 14 yeah. categories of denial. So if I read you the titles, will you rap on them for me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. If we just stop talking about it, racism will go away.
Well, Morgan Freeman says this, and I think it's really weird. The analogy I give is if scientists or doctors said, if we just stop talking about cancer, it would just vanish. I don't think you'd be pleased with a doctor who said that to you. If someone who was trying to create an aeroplane said, if we just stop talking about the Newtonian physics, aeroplanes will fly themselves. I don't think you'd be very satisfied with an engineer who gave you that explanation. And I think it's revealing that because I talk about class as much as I talk about race, because I grew up poor and racialized as black, and interestingly, even my white family's reaction to blackness was interesting because they were really poor. They didn't have a wonderful life at all. Only one side of that conversation upsets people. And so I think that's quite revealing in and of itself.
Okay, stopping you there. Yep. Stop playing the race card.
Well, it's a card, apparently, you know. I think, as was touched on earlier, I think a lot of people, I watched Afua's talk earlier, like my grandmother, for example, is exactly like Afua's grandmother. Despite being an immigrant toilet cleaner, you know, you can imagine the abuse a black immigrant toilet cleaner got in the 60s and 70s. My grandma would never say a word because she felt like, I don't want to make people uncomfortable. Whereas those of us who were born here, it's unfortunate, we shouldn't have been born here then. You know, we don't have that same barrier of we don't have the right to speak. You can't bring someone up and tell them they live in a democratic country where they have the right to free speech and then say, don't speak unless I'm comfortable with it. That's not how a democracy works.
Why can't you just get over it? It's all in the past.
Well, interestingly, no one ever tells me to get over Shakespeare. you know, my company, for those who don't know, has done like thousands of workshops and productions around Shakespeare. And I mean literally thousands, because it's not just me, it's the company. And it's interesting because that is not seen as me celebrating my British heritage. This is what's really fascinating to me. So when I say negative things about Britain, one of the really weird comebacks is you hate the country. And I'm like, what, I hate Welsh miners, Scottish peat farmers, Mount Snowdon, Newtonian physics. What is it you think I hate exactly? Because I criticize the government and criticize the society. But then when I say, look at positive aspects of Britain, when I admire Newtonian physics or read Bertrand Russell or set up a whole company around Shakespeare, that's not really seen as me celebrating my culture because some people don't see that as my culture, which in and of itself is revealing.
You have a chip on your shoulder.
Yeah, I mean, no one knows what those are, but we know that black men have them in particular. Even when they're very successful and they've got nothing to complain about, they still have them, apparently. I'm not sure what they are, though. No one can quite define it.
Why don't you just go back to where you came from?
Yeah, this is a good one. What I like most about this one, for those who are unaware, more immigrants came to Britain. In fact, virtually all of the immigrants that came to Britain in the post-war period, because the people that came from Caribbean and Asia were not immigrants, they were British citizens, came from Europe and Ireland. And what was really fascinating to me growing up is kids whose grandparents came from Poland, which I got no problem with, by the way, love to the Poles, but they would feel entitled to tell me to go back where I came from, even though my maternal ancestors had been on this island for thousands of years, and they speak one of its indigenous languages. It's a really fascinating sense of kind of racial identity.
And that one ties in with the next one, which is, why don't you go back to Africa then, even if you're from the Caribbean?
Yeah, I like that one. I mean, the thing is, what I enjoy about this is people know so little about the places they're telling me to go back to. They don't know that in those places, I'm one of the privileged people. I'm a light-skinned Westerner in Jamaica, and I've got an English accent. Like, when the police pull me over in Jamaica, it's like I'm a posh white guy. Like, I can't explain to you how different it is. That's how I know people are just being silly when they pretend they can't understand the difference in treatment. Like, it's unfathomable how the police talk to me. And the police in Jamaica kill lots of people.
Back in the green room, I caught up with two novelists writing in Spanish, Colombian Juan Gabriel Vasquez, who we've already heard from, and Spain's Javier Cercas, both of whose latest novels entwine fact, fiction, and some sort of autobiography in order to penetrate the dark heart of 20th century politics. Javier, can we start with you? In The Impostor, you look at a famous or infamous man who claimed he was a Holocaust survivor and became quite a celebrity. He was Catalan. Tell us why you wanted to write about this particular character.
You know, I became obsessed by that, by the fact that this man lied on the worst crime, probably the worst crime in history. So when this case, we became aware of this imposture, I was shocked, as everybody, I would say, lots of people in Spain, not only in Spain, because the case became really famous. So I was astonished, and I asked myself, I think that the three questions that are in the center of the book are, why a man should lie about, you know, something like the Nazi camps and things like that, the Holocaust, first of all. Then why everybody believed him? That's a very important question. Nobody questioned his story. You know, he, as you said, he was very famous. He was on TV, he was in radio, he was, historians interviewed him. He talked all the time, you know, to students, he went to the parliament, you know. So he was almost a civil hero, I would say. and why nobody thought that he was lying, or suspected at least, or during years. Can you imagine that? And the last question, and probably the most important, is why I was so shocked by it, by that. Why it was so, I was really shocked. So I think that Juan Gabriel and I are very similar in this sense. I write about what I don't know. When something puts me a question, then I know that, and a serious question, that something that obsesses me, then I know that there is something that can be a novel, right? So yes, and that's the reason.
So Juan, your most recent novel, The Shape of the Ruins, is also an investigation of history. In this case, it's two political assassinations, or maybe political assassinations, which are 30 years apart, yes, in Colombia. Tell us about this particular story.
Yes, well, if there is one historical event that shaped the Colombian experience in the 20th century, it is the murder of this liberal leader, Jorge Eliezer Gaitán, in 1948. This is a kind of Kennedy assassination before the Kennedy assassination, in the sense that it is still unsolved. It really divided the 20th century, the Colombian 20th century, in two, and is the reason of most of the violence that has shaped my country's life in the last 70 years. Now, in 2005, I met this doctor, this Colombian surgeon, who told me that he knew of my interest in the Gaitán assassination, and he had something to show me. He took me to his house, and he produced a vertebra inside this glass jar, a vertebra that belonged to Jorge Eliezer Gaitán. And of course, having this in my hands is just as astonishing and as fertile an anecdote as you can get. But the fact is that at the same time, my twin daughters were born. So this idea, the idea that in time, the coincidence in time of the birth of my daughters and this very direct physical experience of Colombia's violent past just created this question in my head. How does violence get transmitted from generation to generation? In a sense, in a very direct sense, how will my girls that have just been born, how will they inherit the violent moments of Colombia's past, and can I protect them? So this very personal question led to a novel in which the autobiographical gets mixed up with a historical investigation, all around questions that have to deal with a theory of conspiracy that crosses the novel.
You have two witnesses. There's yourself in it, but then there are these two witnesses, one of whom is the surgeon that you mentioned, but another is a sort of paranoid fantasist. Yes. Who is a conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
And I'm very interested in how, in both cases, these novels, you know, ask questions about what is the tropes that have led to the reconstruction of history as we see it, which is, on the one hand, it's a sort of fascination with the anatomy of death, which doesn't give you any, a vertebra doesn't give you any more truth than a conspiracy theory does.
That's
in a
right.
way. And what this says about the way that your novels have shaped themselves as sort of metafictions in a way. They're not just straightforward narratives, because what both of them are saying is you cannot tell a straightforward narrative in these historical situations. Javier?
Yeah. I don't think that I write historical novels, in fact. What I write is novels in which history is important, but in which the past is a dimension of the present, meaning that the past is not dead, it's not even past. That's one of the main leitmotifs of the book. And so, yes, what I try to do in this novel, and I would say in some of the novels, is to link the past with the present, to show that past is still here, that we live in a sort of dictatorship of the present. People think that the present is only now, you know, and yesterday is past, and a week before is like prehistory or something like that. But it's not true. I mean, the past, especially the past of which we still have memory, and witnesses, like this case in this and the imposter, or in Juan Gabriel's novel, this past is still here. To understand what's happening now, we need that. It is part of this, it, that, I insist, that dimension of the present, without which the present is mutilated. To do that is this, you talked about metafiction or something like that, right? It's always working like that in my books, I would say. I sometimes say I write adventure novels on the adventure of writing a novel. Why? Because I think it is compulsory for, in some books, I would say it's almost a moral obligation to show to the reader how you worked. That's part of the attractive, but especially that's part of the story.
You're both Spanish language writers, and these novels exist in a historical tradition. And Juan, you cite Borges, obviously, but also Marquez. I wondered to what extent this is a Spanish tradition, and to what extent this also reflects histories which are so tortured, and perhaps more tortured than we in the Anglophone world would admit of our history.
Yes, probably. Latin American fiction in particular has always been very aware of the tension between the narratives of history and the fiction attempts at exploring history. We have grown as peoples, the Latin American peoples, we have grown up with a certain awareness that the powers that be are always trying to impose a certain version of our past. And one of the roles literature has willingly taken in Latin America is to explore the lies of history. If Gaitán was murdered in 1948 and a certain version of the crime and its consequences has reached us, literature is always there to say things didn't happen that way, things might have happened another way. Those people responsible for the crime are not necessarily the ones that have been pointed out by history. And my novel in particular, I think all my novels try to do this, explore the secrets and the shortcomings and the mysteries of our collective past. But in particular, this one is obsessed with the way we let history tell us lies. It's obsessed with the idea that we invent conspiracy theories whenever we feel that official history is lying or has been distorted or has been suppressed.
And sort of going on from that, Javier, in your novel, you almost posit the question of whether this lie is a truthful representation of what it is like to live under fascism, of suffering under fascism.
Yes, I'm talking about the Spanish guy, but what I'm talking, in fact, is about, you know, as all novels do, about humankind, right? So this is not exclusive of Spanish people. The fact that when we deal with our worst past, both collective or personal, we, not only Spanish, not only Colombians, not only Latin Americans, no, everybody, including British people, tend to, you know, edulcorate it, or mask it, or simply lie on it. And it's true that we have, I mean, we Spanish and Latin American, blah, 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 have, well, difficult pasts. You have a long tradition, you British have a long tradition of democracy, which has, but you have also the same problem. Everybody has the same problem. Everybody has a difficult history. Everybody has moments in the past, the recent past also, in which, you know, the official history wants to say one thing and then the truth is not like that. Or one thing very important is to know that, and one thing that demonstrates that this past is a dimension of the present, is that the first thing the power, not only in Latin America or in Spain, but everywhere, the first thing the power wants is to impose a version of the past. Because they know very well that if you control past, you control present. What we, as Juan Gabriel was saying, we as writers, and I would say as citizens, must do is to fight against these lies. They lie. I mean, they lie because that's the essence of power, to impose a version of the past, because that's the way to impose a version of the present.
And one of the themes that's emerging from this festival is the extent to which the nostalgic myth is asserting itself all over Europe. And I was in a bed and breakfast with an Icelandic novelist, and Iceland have just voted right You know, and it's all because of this myth of the great past, the romantic past. So, and you know, in Poland, look at all across Europe, what's happening because of our failure to face up to the horrors that we ourselves committed.
Yes. Yes, well, this awareness of the past as a narrative, or rather of societies as a fabric of narratives, I think that's part of what we are doing as writers. Try to open a space in which the monolithic version of the past is confronted by our multiple versions as citizens. If you say that a society is a fabric of stories, that means that every single human experience has a slightly different version of his or her historical experience, an experience of his or her past as a citizen of a nation. And literature is the place where this exists. Literature is the place where we not only confront the one single monolithic version that often comes to us imposed from somewhere else, from the power, but we also open up the space in which contradictory, opposed versions of our past can coexist and can relate to each other. That's one of the beautiful things that literature can do.
But politics takes many forms, and the Indian poet Dishani Doshi spoke in a series of sessions at the Hay Festival this year. Claire was so impressed with her after an event with Salman Rushdie that she nabbed her to give us her take on the Me Too movement by a reading of the title poem of her new collection.
Girls are coming out of the woods, wrapped in cloaks and hoods, carrying iron bars and candles and a multitude of scars collected on acres of premature grass and city buses, in temples and bars. Girls are coming out of the woods with panties tied around their lips, making such a noise it's impossible to hear. Is the world speaking too? Is it really asking, what does it mean to give someone a proper resting? Girls are coming out of the woods, lifting their broken legs high, leaking secrets from unfastened thighs. All the lies whispered by strangers and swimming coaches and uncles, especially uncles, who said spreading would be light and easy, who put bullets in their chests and fed their pretty faces to fire, who sucked the mud clean off their ribs and decorated their coffins with briar. Girls are coming out of the woods, clearing a ground to scatter their stories, even those girls found naked in ditches and wells, those forgotten in neglected attics and buried in riverbeds like sediments from a different century. They've crawled their way out from behind the curtains of childhood, the silver-pink weight of their bodies pushing against water, against the sad feathered tarnish of remembrance. Girls are coming out of the woods, the way birds arrive at morning windows, pecking and humming, until all you can hear is the smash of their minuscule hearts against glass, the bright desperation of sound, bashing, disappearing. Girls are coming out of the woods. They're coming. They're coming.
Tishani, that is a very, very powerful poem. And that is the title poem of your new collection, which is just about out. Tell us about it.
So the book is about many things. It's about coastal life, it's about aging, it's about the idea of motherhood. But I think at the center of it is the question of women and bodies. And this poem was written, I guess, in a kind of response to the Delhi rape case in December 2012 when Jyoti Singh was raped on this bus. And I think it was a turning point in the discussion of rape and gender violence in India. It changed laws, it brought young people out into the street, and newspapers started reporting and putting it right up in the front page. And I felt in some way I wanted to use poetry as a way to reclaim those voices and to say that those women who have been silenced, we don't forget them and that they cannot be silenced. So I had this image of them coming out of the woods with these weapons.
Part of the poet's job is to tell the essential truth, isn't it? And we've just been having a conversation, one obviously at this Hay Festival, one of the big conversations is all about Me Too and what the essentials are of it and how the dangers as well of everything getting too overblown and too shrill was a word that's been used.
Yeah. I think it's this sort of, it feels like we're in the middle of a revolution, and of course we've had several revolutions when we're talking about the feminist movement, and this really feels this dismantling of power, which is very necessary, and it's sort of I don't know, it feels reassuring in a way that, you know, people don't have to remain silent and that men and women can say, this happened to me and, you know, I want to sort of say it out loud. But I do think, yeah, there is, you know, everything is so complicated. Humans are complicated. Sexuality is complicated. So we're going to have to work through how we go forward with this momentum.
Tishani Doshi there. But in the best possible way, Hay isn't always entirely grown up. Here's a taster of Tracy Corduroy and Steve Lenton's session on Liverpool ex-robbers turned bakers Shifty McGifty and Slippery Sam.
Ready? 3, 2, 1.
Forwards!
Oh, he's got two! He's got three!
Hay is such a fun place for kids and for adults like me who love talking about kids' books. So I was lucky enough to interview Horrid Henry author Francesca Simon and mythology expert and author Kevin Crossley Holland at an event about Norse mythology. Francesca's latest book is The Monstrous Child, which is told through the eyes of Hel, god of the underworld, and Stroppy Teenager, while Kevin's latest collection is Norse Myths, Tales of Odin, Thor, and Loki.
The gods were the gods that you and I would want, really, if we'd been Vikings. Gods of inspiration, of poetry, of healing, of law, of marriage, of a long life, or at least a life lived honourably. But everything in your life is represented, wouldn't you say, Francesca, by one of the gods or goddesses of the North?
Yes, I think that's true, but I also think that it's important to remember that we are also, you know, coming smack up against a very different concept of gods. I mean, these are gods who are indifferent. The gods actually spend very little time interacting with humans, which is very different from the Greek gods, who seem to have nothing better to do than to interfere in our world. The Viking gods are really chilled. I mean, chilly. They're not chilled. But they are pretty indifferent to humans. They're not that concerned about them. They're interested in their own stories of, you know, birth and death and rivalry. So we kind of identify with them and their struggles, but not in their relationship to us, which is personally the reason I think why the Vikings went all over, as Kevin says, but noticed that they didn't spread their religion anywhere.
I suppose
they got converted, because their religion, I think, offers very little to people. You know, if you have the choice of gods who don't care about you, and when you die, unless you're a great warrior, you will go down to the world of the dead, hell, where you'll just flit around and moan. Or you have the choice of another religion, which is a god who is riveted by you, who you can chat to, who cares about you, who loves you. And if you behave well, you can join said god in heaven. Well, I mean, that's your choice.
The strange thing is that they may not care, but they represent, in their day-to-day lives,
of course,
human beings.
Definitely.
The robustness, the laughter, the jokes, the boasting, the terrors, the passions, it's all there, but it's on a different level.
Yeah.
But there's a deep, deep fatalism in Norse mythology. It's driving towards an inescapable end. And that, we can certainly agree, I think.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, and that's a very interesting idea, I think, too, that you have gods who also know how they're going to die. So this idea that they're not really that immortal, because, you know, Odin is missing an eye, and the god Tyr is missing a hand, and the god Heimdall is blind. So you have all these wounded people walking around who were supposedly immortal gods. You have Hel, who is half human and half corpse. So it's, again, a very almost human, because, you know, there must have been an awful lot of people who were missing bits walking around in Viking times. But it's very interesting that rather than having idealized gods, you actually have very wounded, damaged gods.
And one of the reasons for that is that the agent of change in Norse mythology is the figure called Loki. And he's the son of a goddess and a giant. That's unusual, quite
it's
often.
It's forbidden. It's
the other
terrible.
Way around, it does
the other
happen.
Way around is fine. So you, you can be a
That's
god.
Right. So he's described as a blood brother of Odin, the greatest of the gods. But the thing about Loki is that without him, nothing would change very much. But he begins by playing innocent practical tricks, not very innocent, but not deadly, but by the end of the myths, entirely deadly and not innocent in the least.
Perhaps we should just all grow up. But when exactly does that happen? The neuroscientist Sarah Jane Blakemore is the author of a fascinating new book called Inventing Ourselves, which looks at cutting-edge research into the adolescent brain and finds out, among other things, that it carries on changing and developing much later than we used to think.
So here's a really beautiful illustration of typical adolescent behaviour. This is from a reader who wrote to the Guardian newspaper a few years ago. So this is a reader called Dina Hall, and she says, "There's nothing like teenage diaries for putting momentous historical events in perspective. This is my entry for the 20th of July, 1969. I went to art centre by myself in yellow cords and blouse. Ian was there, but he didn't speak to me. Got a poem put in my handbag from someone who's apparently got a crush on me. It's Nicholas, I think. Ugh. Man landed on moon." So what's nice about that illustration, that diary extract, is less important is the fact that man happened to land on the moon for the very first time that day. More important are things like what Dina is wearing, who she likes, who she doesn't like. So what is adolescence? Claire mentioned that her child, still 24, might be considered an adolescent. So it's really not a straightforward question to answer. Some people think of adolescence as teenagers, so 13 to 19, the teenage years. According to the World Health Organization, adolescence is defined as the second decade of life. Stanley Hall, who was the first person to coin the word adolescence to describe this age group, about 100 years ago in the USA, defined it as the period of life that starts at puberty, so around 12 or 13 back then, and ending between 22 and 25 years. But most researchers, including me today, define it as follows. We define it as beginning at puberty, so the beginning of adolescence is defined biologically with the hormonal and physical changes at puberty. The end of adolescence has a much more vague and fuzzy definition, which is the age at which you attain a stable, independent role in society. So this can go on a long time, and there may be quite a few of you here, by the sounds of it, who wonder whether they might still fit that definition. What you can see by this definition is the huge cultural differences associated with this, the way we conceptualize this age group. In our culture here in the West, it's completely socially acceptable to be in full-time education, to be living at home with your parents throughout the teens, of course, but even into the 20s or 30s, whereas that's not the case for other cultures. In some other cultures around the world, young people are expected to become independent, so they're expected to go out and earn their own money as soon as they can as children, and they're expected to have babies as soon as they reach sexual maturity. Some people have argued, because of these really big cultural differences, that adolescence is an invented phenomenon, coined, as I mentioned, by Stanley Hall about 100 years ago in the US, and doesn't really exist as a biological period of development. But I would argue that actually that's not the case. And there are three really good reasons why we should think of adolescence as a unique period of biological, psychological, and social development. And that is because we see these adolescent typical behaviors like risk-taking and exploration of the environment and impulsivity and even peer influence across species, not just limited to humans, across culture and across histories.
Now I'm just thoroughly confused. But then, isn't that just exactly how a good literary festival should make you feel?
As this Hay special is going out a few days early to catch the end of the festival, we'll be back on the 12th of June with our Guardian Live event with the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.